Again, hello. Tell me, is the lighting okay for everybody? The lighting fine. I'm very concerned with lighting. I'm quite sad it's not a dimmer because I like to fiddle with it. Ever since I got a course evaluation 2 years ago from a student whose response to the question, "What did you value about the course?" was the mood lighting. That and that only was what he valued about the course. So I thought, you know, if nothing else goes right, at least the lighting can be moved. Thinking of installing a disco ball. Yesterday we began this little series of introductory lectures by thinking about the famous ontological argument, nearly 1,000 years old, but at least to me still fresh, still fascinating and profound, originated by St. Anselm. And we talked a little bit yesterday about what might be wrong with it, if there is something wrong with it, but I want to spend some time on a famous rejoinder, a famous response to this argument by the monk I mentioned called Guarnino. And his response, I think, is still powerful more than 900 years after it was propounded. As I said, it's a reductio ad absurdum, a reduction to the absurd. Guarnino doesn't tell us what's wrong with the argument. He just attempts to show that we could use the argument to generate all sorts of absurd conclusions. So there must be something wrong with it. It's not clear what's wrong, but clearly, if Guarnino is right, it's flawed. And yesterday I gave you a little piece of homework, or for those averse to the term, a little something to think about before today, which is how Guarnino's reductio would work. Guarnino begins by asking, does the perfect island exist? Let me remind you briefly of how Anselm's argument worked. He said, well, the perfect being can only have two statuses, two only. There's no other options. Either the perfect being is just fictional, just imaginary, merely made up, or the perfect being is real. And Anselm is assuming we'll go along with the notion that the perfect being is God. So if he shows the perfect being is real, he's shown that God exists. Okay? So here are the two options. Well, one of these options, says Anselm, clearly doesn't work. It can't be that the perfect being is merely imaginary. Why is that? Because real existence confers more greatness than imaginary existence. If the perfect being were merely imaginary, it wouldn't really be perfect. There's only one option left, and that is that the perfect being is real. That's his conclusion. So what is Guarnino's reductio? He begins by asking, does the perfect island exist? Anybody want to continue for us? How's the reduction going to happen? How will it continue? You can just pop up your hand and then I'll know who to respond to. Yes, in the front.
It might be a little bit offline, but I've been wondering about the fact that all the material we've had at the summer school these last months has been dealing with veneration of the perfect in art and in music and in architecture. Now, if we find that God doesn't exist, what do we do now to actually venerate venerate that which is the ideal or that which is the perfect? How do we, in fact, motivate idealism and creativity? Because much of what we read and hear and see is all to do with the existence of an almighty, for want of a better term.
I guess it depends on the choice of courses you attend.
Without the existence of God, I wouldn't attend many courses at all.
So the existence of God has a real practical importance for you to determine what you call in the summer school.
It has importance for the material that we are listening to.
It seems to me that if you're attending a number of courses in the history of philosophy or the history of art or the history of theology, you're likely continually to come across the notion of the perfect.
Right.
And naturally there was veneration of this perfect being or an attempt to create a perfect artwork and so on. One of the things you seem to say was, if there is no God, then what happens to the notion of perfection? Is that right?
Right.
Okay. Well, this may be a less exciting notion than the concept of God, but maybe you can take comfort in, for example, geometrical objects. I mean, circles are perfect in their own way, right? A circle is a set of points equidistant from a central point. There's nothing imperfect about that. So if the notion of perfection is important to you, have a circle. Or any geometric or indeed mathematical object.
I would prefer the paeta.
The what?
The paeta.
The paeta.
Oh, well, I mean, you were worried that the paeta refers to some kind of theological doctrine that isn't true. And if it isn't true, I can't help you there. So I'm offering you mathematical objects as a consolation prize.
We can agree to differ.
Any responses to the question, how is Garnido's argument going to go? Yes?
Are you talking here about human beings, and also God is supposed to be, we are supposed to be, have been made in the image of God. So God, we are attributing anthropomorphic properties. Now, perfection is not a logical concept when applied to human beings or gods with properties of human beings. It's just not a logical concept.
I wonder if your point is really a criticism of Anselm's attempt, of Garnido's attempt to refute Anselm's argument by applying it in the context of islands. So it feels to me like you're a step ahead of the rest of us. I want to think about how Garnido's argument is going to work. You seem to be working at refuting Garnido's argument.
I'm saying that Anselm's idea is nonsense.
Because nonsense.
The idea of perfection is not a logical concept when applied to human beings or gods. It's just not logical.
Well, it may not be true when applied to human. I'm not sure what a logical concept amounts to. It may not be true when applied to human beings, but at least a number of religious thinkers, presumably with some exceptions, think that it's entirely appropriate when applied to God.
And what does it mean? Does it mean he never has a, never gets out of bed on a bad day or something? What does it mean?
Okay, that is a good question. Now, I want to hold objections to Anselm's argument for a few minutes, and I want to deal with Garnido's reduction, and then we'll get to what we think about Anselm's argument. Here's Garnido's reductio ad absurdum. Does the perfect island exist? Well, really, there are two possible statuses for the perfect island. Let's follow Anselm's method. It's either merely imaginary, fictional, or it's real. Now, it can't just be imaginary. If the perfect island were imaginary, it wouldn't really be perfect, because it would be greater if it were real. So the perfect island is real. What an exciting conclusion. I've shown celebrations on the perfect island after the discovery that they are real. It's actually a scene from Hawaii. But Garnido thinks this is an effective refutation of Anselm's argument because the conclusion is surely absurd. How could we conclude that there is a real perfect island just by these methods of argument? Here is Garnido's point. He says, this ontological argument seeks to establish the existence of a perfect being. But you could use exactly the same method to conclude the existence of a perfect thing in any other category. The perfect island exists, the perfect ice cream exists. Choose your category and you can use Anselm's method to conclude that the perfect thing in that category exists. He says clearly this is absurd, this is ridiculous. So Anselm's method must somehow be flawed. And if you were a follower of Anselm, what you would have to do is show that this counterexample, this reduction, is somehow problematic. That Anselm's method is only meant to work for beings in general. It's not meant to apply to islands. It's not meant to apply to ice creams. Where are we? We've thought about Anselm's argument. We've had a look at Garnido's reduction, which doesn't tell us what's wrong with it. It just says there's something wrong with it. Now let's ask ourselves, does this ontological argument establish, after all our discussion...
What's ontological mean?
I'll tell you in a moment. Thanks for the question. I actually had a note to myself saying almost exactly that same thing. Does the argument establish that the perfect being is real? And if you don't like the argument, what exactly is wrong with it? What does ontological mean? It means having to do with existence. When philosophers speak about an ontology, they mean the category of things that exist. So in your ontology, you might include, for instance, numbers. You might say numbers exist. Numbers are real. We can't see them or touch them, but nonetheless, in some sense, they exist. Or you might exclude them. You might say it's useful for us, it's a helpful tool to speak of numbers, but they don't really, in any substantial sense, exist. So the ontological argument is an argument having to do with existence, in particular, to do with the existence of God. Now, we had a point earlier, the gentleman said, what exactly are we talking about when we say the perfect being? And this is a legitimate philosophical tool, the tool of criticizing an argument. Let me go back and show you that argument as I set it up. Real existence confers more greatness than fictional existence, so no fictional being is perfect, and so the perfect being is real. Now, as I said, either you object to the assumption, or you object to the way Anselm leaps to the second line and then to the third. Well, perhaps the objection here, the objection being made, is to the third line. The objection might be you can't leap to the third line because the third line makes no sense. Why does it make no sense? Because we don't actually know what we mean by the perfect being. We can say we have a phrase, the perfect being, but what's behind it? It's quite an empty phrase. Now this may sound quite a sophisticated objection, but really it's just a polite philosophical way of saying what we often say to people we disagree with, which is, I don't know what you're talking about, right? We get to line three, we see the first three words, and we think, I don't know what you're talking about. So that is one way to object to the argument. It's to say, Anselm, you really need to explain yourself, because I have no idea what you mean by the perfect being. I guess a response he could offer is, whatever perfect being may mean, we might try to fill it in different ways, all he wants to say about it is that perfection of a being involves it really existing rather than being merely imagined. That's all he needs to claim in order for his argument to go through. Are there any other... Tell me, does anybody feel that the ontological argument has something to it, that there's something right about it, something good about it? Yes. Would you like to... And over here as well. But see, in fact, there's good support from the left-hand side. That left-hand side could hear me more clearly when I set up the argument. I was standing here when I gave the objections. Keep up your hand. I'm interested to know if you think that there's something right or at least profound in this argument. Yeah. Of those people who like the argument, is there anything you'd like to offer in favor of it? To say in favor of it? Yes.
Well, I think on the face of it,
yes.
Something fictional has less value than something that exists as real.
Yeah. I mean, philosophy so often is like this. Reading philosophy often feels a bit like, if it's good philosophy, often feels a bit like nodding to yourself for a while until you begin dozing slightly and then suddenly waking up with a shock, right? Because what the philosopher does is starts with an assumption or two which seems perfectly fair and reasonable. You're not inclined to object. And then beginning with those assumptions reaches a shocking conclusion. You think, wow, how did they get that? That's what Anselm does. And as the man has just said, the assumption seems okay, at least to some of us. I tried to substantiate it yesterday. I tried to say, well, being fictional does seem to involve less greatness than being real. Somebody said to me after the lecture, because I was not satisfied with the term greater, somebody said, what about superior? Perhaps we're speaking of degrees of superiority, which I like. So you might like to say that instead. But for many of us, that does seem to be the case. There's something special about the horse. The horse is real. The unicorn and the griffin and the chimera and the dragon are all very fancy creatures. We can make up as many as we like, but they are not real. The horse has a measure of greatness that they do not because it's real. Moreover, a horse can act directly in the world. The unicorn and the chimera can't. They're just figments of our imagination. So if you like this assumption, you might go directly to the third point and say, well, yeah, the perfect being is real. let's turn now to those who don't like the argument. It's all very well saying there's something wrong with it, but what is wrong with it? See if you can put your finger on the essence. Where's the problem? Yes.
But I object to all the terms that he's using. It seems to me that it's terribly kind of stuck in a particular time frame.
Yes. Look, I mean, his excuse was he was writing in the 1000s, so. Yes. Yes.
What is God? What is great? Except. I mean, why must you see God as, if there's such a thing as a God, as perfect? Can we not be an imperfect prime mover or something?
Yes.
Why have you got to try to prove that God is perfect and therefore he exists?
Yes.
Can be imperfect and exists as well.
Right.
So all the terms seem to me to be problematic.
Well, it seems to me you've raised two different objections in relation to the notion of perfection. The first is an echoing, a bolstering of the objection made earlier, which is what is understood here by perfect. Clarified for us, Anselm, and I said on Anselm's behalf, he might say, look, you could fill it in various ways, but all I need to say about perfection is that it's got to involve existence. Maybe that's not as satisfactory to you. But your other objection is to say, well, Anselm assumes we'll be nodding away when he says, you know, by God, we understand the perfect being. Perhaps we understand God differently. Perhaps we think, well, maybe the ontological argument succeeded. It's shown there's a perfect being, but that's not the God I know. The God I know may be imperfect in various ways. It's another notion of God. Yes, at the back.
Can we then conclude that to exist in the imagination and not in reality has no value?
No, let's not go so far. I mean, that would be awful. I mean, one couldn't read Superman comics without feeling guilty and doing something worthless without value. He doesn't go that far. He just wants to say that if you compare two things just the same, except that one really exists, the one that really exists is greater than the one that doesn't. He doesn't want to say that the one that's just imaginary has no value at all. That would be harsh.
But yes. Isn't there no...
Sorry, the person to behind you and to your left.
What is a being?
Actually, I was pointing at a different person. Yes, you. Yes, yes.
What is the definition of greatness? I mean, what does that mean?
Okay.
You can't hear the question.
Sorry, what is the meaning of greatness?
What we have is an assault from this audience on Anselm's terms. And I feel responsible for Anselm. I mean, he can't speak for himself, so let me try. Perhaps we should understand by greatness the proximity to perfection. Okay, now we've worried about what perfect means, but I'm going to try and reduce two worries. What is perfection? What is greatness? To one worry. I feel like that's an achievement. I mean, you know, many of us have so many worries in our lives, it's nice when some of them disappear. So, suppose we have two worries about Anselm. We don't know what perfection means, and we don't know what greatness means. The best I can do for now is reduce it to one worry. Suppose we understand greatness in terms of proximity to perfection. Then we have a notion of greatness. All we have to know is, what is perfection? There, Anselm fails us if you want a full account. All he wants to say is that existence is going to be a property of the perfect being rather than mere imaginary status. Does anybody have a worry of a different kind? Because I feel now we're firmly familiar with worries about what he may mean by perfection or greatness. Yes. Anybody concerned? Yes, over there.
The problem is it's a secular argument.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it is. It's a secular argument.
It is?
Yeah. He's saying God is real, therefore God is real. Perfect being has got to be real to be perfect, therefore a perfect being is real. It's a circular argument.
Well, I was in my response earlier, I was not as careful as I could be. Let's rely on this slide instead. Now, a circular argument or a question-begging argument is an argument which states its conclusion in the premise. Perhaps it's a little bit hidden, but it's there. It's an argument, in effect, which repeats itself. It doesn't achieve anything. It doesn't reach a conclusion by hard work. It begins with a conclusion, then moves around a bit, and then reaches the conclusion. That doesn't achieve anything, a circular argument. It just repeats itself. It wouldn't persuade anybody, because anybody not already persuaded of the conclusion would step off at the premise and say, I don't believe you. Is this argument circular? It seems to me that it's not quite. I mean, it seems to me that this assumption is not identical to this conclusion, and nor is this one. It seems to me rather that it's a deductive argument. It's an attempt at a deductive argument. I won't say what that is. For those of you who know, that's fine. It tries to pull this conclusion out of this premise, but it does some work in doing so. It doesn't boldly state the conclusion in the premise. I want us to move on now. I'm very happy if you want to think about the ontological argument and talk to me afterwards. But I want to think now of the next question in the series, which is, what is the mind? Some people think it's a kind of thing. If so, what kind of thing is it? And the thinker who I'm going to use as my springboard is René Descartes, this great French philosopher. And in the manner of philosophers of some 100 years ago, he wasn't just a philosopher. He was also a mathematician and a scientist. He was great in every endeavor. In mathematics, we owe the development of analytic geometry to Descartes. In the sciences, he explored topics including the nature of light. For example, Descartes explored the causes of rainbows. And in mathematics and philosophy, he was quite prolific. Probably his most famous work is Meditations on First Philosophy from 1641. It's a work of tremendous ambition. That is one of the fun aspects of reading in the history of philosophy. 21st century philosophers are often very careful. They often write large volumes on relatively small questions. They've become in some ways hyper-specialized. Philosophers of the 17th and 18th century have no such qualms. So the Meditations on First Philosophy includes, among other things, an attempt to found the whole of human nature on an absolutely irrefutable foundation. Descartes says he's worried about the fact that most of our beliefs seem to be open to doubt. They seem to be shaky. He wants to find a belief which isn't at all open to doubt. It's irrefutable. And he wants to build the rest of human knowledge on top of that. It's a remarkably ambitious plan. Does anybody know what that belief is, by the way? The one that he regards as absolutely irrefutable. It's the rock. Yes, excellent. My own existence, he thinks, is absolutely irrefutable. For one thing, you wouldn't even be able to doubt it in a reasonable way. If you were to doubt your own existence, somebody could reasonably say, well, who's doing the doubting? If there's doubt, there's got to be a doubter. And admittedly, it's a really slender basis to build the whole of human knowledge on, but Descartes tries hard. And he thinks everything is constructible on this. What we're going to focus on is the attempt in the Meditations to show that the human mind or soul, I'm going to use those for now interchangeably, to show that the human mind is not a physical thing at all. It's an immaterial thing. Let's see how he does this. Let's have two options about what kinds of beings we are. And I'm going to begin in this way because this is not just an abstruse, abstract kind of question about psychology. This is a really important question when we ask what kind of thing is the mind. It's a really important question about what sorts of beings, what sorts of creatures we are. One option is to say we are entirely physical creatures. All of me is physical. If you take away my physical part, you take away my body, there is nothing left. That's it. That's not to say that we're simple. Not at all. We are immensely complex physical creatures, and richly rewarding scientific careers are devoted to understanding our physical constituents. So this is one option when we think about what kinds of creatures we are. And here is another option. It's to say that we're compound creatures. We're two in one. We have two parts which are somehow conjoined. One part is physical, but the other part is immaterial or non-physical. You could call it our mind. You could call it our soul. Somehow it's conjoined with us, and it's not our physical part. It seems to me that this is not only a question of intrinsic interest, what kinds of creatures we are, but also a question with tremendous consequences. Can there be life for me after my bodily death? Might it be that in some way I had life before my bodily existence? Well, it looks like the second option about what kinds of creatures we are makes these things possible. But it would be very difficult to believe in them if you believe the first option, if you were to believe we were entirely physical. If I'm an entirely physical creature, if nothing of me remains when the body is removed, then it's hard to say how I can have life after bodily death. It's hard to say that my mind or soul survives. If my mind or my soul are physical, then they are gone when my body is no longer. By contrast, if they exist in a non-bodily sense, somehow conjoined to my body, then it might be, it is at least possible, that somehow this immaterial mind or soul continues to exist when my body is gone. So the stakes, I feel, are really high, and it interests me that just by thinking these matters through, we can make a little progress on this question of whether I am purely physical or I have an immaterial mind or soul attached to me. Does anybody have thoughts? Does anybody have a motivation at the moment for choosing option A, the physical option, or option B, the compound option? Does anybody wish to offer an argument for either one?
I think I'll go with physical body.
I also go with a physical body. You're going with the physical option. The whole lot of us is the mind too is physical. Okay.
Yes, because I don't think there's any evidence to show there is in fact a soul.
Okay, maybe the argument is something like this. In the absence of evidence for the non-physical part, we should take the simpler option. Why believe in an extra bit for which there is no evidence? Perhaps that's the argument. Is there another argument? Yes, behind you.
Just one thing that I find a bit worrying about that argument is that, or just in general about having only a physical body and mind,
yes,
is that I think it makes the room for free will a bit narrower. In the sense that you could argue that if everything physical is determined by physical laws and our mind is physical, then maybe our mind and all the things that we think are just neurons firing and one of yours providing those kinds of things.
It's a good point, and I would like to hold that thought for tomorrow when we think about free will more broadly.
Could you tell us what the point was? God here.
The point was, if we are entirely physical, including our minds, this seems to be a problem for the claim that we have free will, that we can act freely. It seems, at least on the face of it, that purely physical beings don't have freedom. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Part of what we'll do is talk about that. Any other? Yes?
Are you equating the mind with the brain?
I'm not doing anything like that. I'm just giving you the two options, and the physical option might say the mind is the brain, or the mind is part of the brain. But as long as it
goes, the brain's going to go.
Yeah, the brain's going to go.
And then the mind's going to go.
And then the mind's going to go because the mind, if this is the physical view,
then you
just is the brain.
Identify the soul. What is the soul?
Well,
I've done anatomy. I've never come across a soul.
Well, you might have. It's just that you poked it, and it was kind of squishy, and you didn't realize that was the soul. Anybody who may not have spoken yet today who wants to offer an argument, either for the first option or the second one, yes. Yes.
I'm going to number two.
Yes.
Because I've got a medical background.
That is a very interesting argument. So if I understand, so I will repeat the point. The person who offered this response has a medical background, and she says, we don't treat the mind. Right? When we're treating some illness a person has, we don't treat a mental problem in the way that we do a physical problem. And this, presumably, so the argument goes, is evidence that the mind isn't physical, because we treat problems of the mind in such a different way from the way we treat problems of the body. Okay, and I presume you would want to say, that's not simply because problems of the mind are problems of a very special part of the body, the brain. You don't want to say that. You want to say that problems altogether different to the kinds of physical problems a person might come across. That's an interesting argument. Anybody else want to offer arguments for this second option? I ask that because Descartes takes the second option. We're going to lead into those. Anybody else like the second option, want to say something in favor of it? Yes?
It may not be a strict answer to your invitation, but I do think one needs to grapple in this very precise concept with neuropsychology, and particularly the fundamentalist neuropsychologists. And I also think that if one's entire existence is physical, where does one place morality? Is that just an illusion?
Well, let me take the second question first, and then let me worry about the first question afterwards, because I don't know what to say to the first question. As for the second question, what happens to morality if we don't have a non-physical part? If we're solely physical, if we don't have an immaterial part.
Yeah.
Well, what happens to morality if we do have an immaterial part? I mean, it's not clear to me, at least on the face of it, that adding this bit, which is difficult to draw because it's non-physical, I've kind of had to represent it with a dotted line that's as close to non-physical as I can get on a slide. What happens if we do have this bit to morality? It doesn't feel to me that adding the conjoined bit, is going to explain the existence of morality. We'd have to do a lot more work. So if you're worried about the place of morality in a world where we're purely physical, I feel one may as well also worry about the place of morality in a world where we've got an immaterial bit as well. Both of them deserve some worry and are troubling problems. Let me move to your first point about grappling with neuropsychology. Since I have failed to grapple with neuropsychology, what I'm going to do is this. As I go through my argument, and it'll take us the rest of today and move into tomorrow, those of you who are versed in neuropsychology might like to point out where the philosophical reflection goes awry. That would be helpful. Okay. Now, if we're going to think... Sorry, I thought it was the beginning of the flamenco. It was like the slide with the perfect island. It was exciting. I mean, it's still exciting to know what you have to say.
I just wanted to raise a point from a previous point that was brought up there about the treatment of a physical condition is different from the way a mental condition is treated.
Yes.
I would like to say that the same happens in animals. You have an animal that is physically ill, and you can also have an animal that is psychologically damaged and has to be approached from a different... So you can apply it to humans and animals, kind of that same point.
Now, that is an interesting point. What do you want to do with it? You're just giving it to me to work with. well, I guess there are at least two things you could do with that point. One is to say that the conclusion we are meant to draw by the person who made the remark there, that humans have a non-physical part, is a conclusion we could equally make in the case of animals. And you might conclude, humans have a non-physical part, and so animals do as well. Another is to reason in the other direction and to say, clearly it would be absurd to ascribe the status of an immaterial soul to this entire kingdom of creatures. which would amount to a reductio absurdum of the point made there. You would say, we could use her argument to show that this vast variety of animals also have souls. They clearly don't, so there's something wrong with her argument. So those are two things you may wish to do with it. Yes?
We agree on the existence of things like personality and creativity and a bunch of other sort of intangibles. Surely that has, those are all functions of a brain. So isn't this, the mind also sort of a function of the brain? You know, there's a lot of stuff that we can't sort of physically clarify, but they definitely do exist. I mean, without my brain, I don't have personality.
Sure.
But I can't exactly prove I have a personality, which is intangible. So how do you think that falls into the same sort of...
It's a good point, and I will say something about this in a few minutes. The idea is, clearly there's a very intimate relationship between the mind and the brain. That's something that would be very difficult to deny. Now, yes, of course, very few people would deny that there's some really close relationship between the mind and the brain. There may be all kinds of correlations, so that when I'm feeling joyful, it may always be that some particular portion of my brain is stimulated in various ways, for example. But there is a big difference between an intimate relationship, so that, for example, events in the mind cause events in the brain and vice versa, and actual identity. The question is whether there is identity. Because if you hold, even if you hold that there's an immaterial, non-physical mind, you might still add that despite it being immaterial, there is constant causal activity between the mind and the brain. It's going to be difficult to do. I'll say that in a few minutes. But at least on the face of it, you can say that. You can say they're not the same, but events in the brain cause events in the mind and vice versa. But your intimacy point is a good one, and I think it's undeniable. Okay. Now, what does the mind contain? If we want to think about what kind of thing the mind is, because that's what this question amounts to. Is the mind or soul immaterial, separate from us, or is it a physical part of us, like the brain? Well, it's helpful to think, what does the mind contain? And here are some examples of mental states. Presumably, we have a vast stock of beliefs, right? I believe I'm lecturing now to take a really dull belief, but it's a belief that I have. We have a vast stock of desires. I want to lecture now. And we have a tremendous number of conscious experiences. Perhaps some of those experiences are of things that are really in front of us. All of us now have experiences of being in this lecture room. And some of those experiences are ones that we can conjure up ourselves in our imagination. We can close our eyes to make it easier and conjure up all kinds of experiences. And these, people often say, are mental states. So the mind contains all sorts of things, including beliefs and desires and conscious experiences. Now, to be clear about the two options, one option is often called materialism or physicalism, and this option says that the mind is physical. Let's keep it simple. Let's suppose that the physicalist says that the mind is the brain or some part of the brain, because the brain does seem to be intimately related to our mind, perhaps more intimately than other parts of our body. Now, boldly put, the materialist or physicalist says all these mental states, the belief that I'm a philosopher, my wanting of ice cream, my pain, my joy, and so on, they're all in here. They're all states of the brain. It's not that they're intimately related, that they cause states of the brain or vice versa. They are states of the brain. Poke a bit of brain working in a certain way, and you will be poking the belief that I'm a philosopher. Descartes thought something different. His position, known as Cartesian dualism, named after him, is that we are beings whose physical parts are conjoined with non-physical or immaterial parts. It's dualist. It's a belief in two kinds of things that make us up. Now, the dualist says that my belief and my desire and my conscious experiences and my feelings are not here. To take up the point made earlier, the dualist doesn't deny that there's some important correlation between my mental and physical states. The dualist is not going to deny that whenever I feel delighted, a certain part of my brain lights up in some way, and that there are causal relations between my mental and physical states. The dualist is going to deny that the mind is identical to the brain. The mind isn't here. Where is it? Well, it's not physical at all. I can't give you an accurate picture of it. because it's not to be found in physical space. Now, I've been a little vague. Unfortunately, I feel I can't be more precise, and I'll take up that point in a minute. What I want to do now is to offer an argument for this position, for Cartesian dualism, and then argue, and it's an argument as compelling as I can make it, and then afterwards, and I guess that may well be tomorrow, after that, argue for physicalism, and we'll see what we think of these arguments. So there's this non-physical substance. My mind consists of this substance. Here's how the argument goes. We begin with the preliminary. I've shown you a picture of two Smurfs. I mean, they don't have to be Smurfs. The Smurfs aren't essential to this philosophical argument. It's just, it's helpful to me. How is it that we know that these two pictures are different? Well, explore the Smurfs for a while and you'll begin to notice some differences. I'm not going to tell you the differences. Yeah, I know, the eyes, the flowers. And just by identifying the eyes and the flowers and so on, we know that these pictures are different because implicitly we are relying on Leibniz's law of identity, a principle named after the great philosopher and mathematician Gottfried Leibniz, who says two things, X and Y, are identical if and only if they have exactly the same properties. Why are these pictures not identical? Because they don't share exactly the same properties. There's a flower here, there isn't a flower here, so the pictures aren't identical. In fact, more fundamentally, another reason they're not identical is that they're located in different places. They can't be identical. It's a really simple principle, but the reason I mention it is, firstly, that we're going to need it explicitly for this argument for dualism, and secondly, that in philosophy, it's so seldom that we come across an apparently uncontentious, uncontroversial principle that we're really excited to write it down and mention it when we do. We're swimming in deep waters in philosophy, and whatever we can cling to, we do. So if Leibniz's law is going to be useful, let's mention it and think about it and be proud of the fact that we all agree that it's right. Maybe we don't. Most of us agree that it's right. Now, bearing in mind Leibniz's law, we now have a test to think about whether the mind and, let's say, the brain are the same thing. Are mental states brain states? Well, Leibniz's law suggests the following test. What we can do is compare the properties of a state of mind and a brain state. And if the properties are exactly the same, then the state of mind is the brain state. And if there's even one difference, then the state of mind isn't a state of the brain. Seems straightforward, right? Okay. Are people with me so far? Because it's important to be... Okay, good. So here we go. What we're going to do is try to pinpoint a particular kind of mental state. We're going to compare this in a while to a state of the brain. But let's all create a certain mental state. It's going to be a kind of experience. It won't be an experience of anything outside us. It will be inwardly focused. It's going to be something we're going to imagine. But we're going to exercise our minds. You might wish to close your eyes if you find it easier to imagine things in that way. Or keep them open as you like. So I would like you to imagine now that it's a hot day and that you're standing on the edge of a yacht in a peaceful tropical sea. And you dive off the yacht into cool, refreshing blue water. Down you go, you're cutting deeper, and you let the cool water embrace you. And far below, beneath you, on the seabed, half hidden beneath the soft sand, you notice what seems to be a wooden box, and you swim towards it. Okay, open your eyes again if they were closed. Keep them open if they were open. And we're going to see if we can use this imaginative experience in an argument for dualism. We're going to see if we can show that the mental state you've just been in is not identical to a physical state, in particular to a state of the brain. How do we do that? Well, Leibniz's law says all we need to show is that there's at least one property of the mental state which the physical state doesn't have, or vice versa. Let's try. Let's think about that experience in the arts. Well, I had a special kind of access to my mental state while I was creating and enjoying it. For one thing, it was private, right? It was like my own private movie theater. Only I had access to it. For another thing, my access was immediate. I didn't need any special tools to have that experience, to have access to my mental state. It was absolutely without any kind of mediation that I had the access. I had immediate private access to my mental states. Now let's think about states of the brain. Right? The physicalist is interested in physical states in general, but we're going to think about the brain in particular. We could think about any physical state. My access to my brain states is rather different. It's not private and immediate. Firstly, I'd require some instruments to have proper access to my brain states. Right? I'd require special sophisticated instrumentation to know precisely what was going on in my brain. Right? So it's not immediate access. And secondly, the access is not private, it's public. This instrumentation, which shows me what is going on in my brain, is not just available to me. Anybody can have a look. We can all circle around and watch what my brain is doing when I'm imagining this experience of diving into the sea. So my access to my experience of diving was private and immediate. My access to my states of brain is public and mediated by instrumentation, quite sophisticated kinds. What does that show? Leibniz's law seems to imply that the mental state I was entertaining for myself is therefore not identical to any brain state, because they have certain properties which are not in common. That is how the argument goes. My mother-in-law has just said no, so I fear to support the argument further. Okay. Somebody else said no. She said perfect. So I shan't criticize this argument. That's how the argument goes. I find it devastatingly simple, and though it's not precisely what Descartes says, this genius of a philosopher worked out similar kinds of arguments in an attempt to show that the mind is not a physical thing. Let's be explicit about the conclusion a Cartesian dualist might wish us to draw. Mental states, at least some of those, the ones we've thought about, the ones involving some kind of experience, aren't physical states. So it seems that mental states, since they aren't states of a physical thing, are states of something that isn't physical. We have physical states, states of our body, and we have mental states, states of a non-physical component of us. It looks like, if you're following and agreeing all this way, that we're special. We are two-in-one creatures. We're compound creatures. It appears to open the possibility then for instance, life after death. I mean, there's something a bit inappropriate about the staircase leading to heaven, because I guess once your body goes, you don't need the stairs, right? Your immaterial part will take you in a stairless way to the non-physical realm. But the point is that if this is right, then at least the possibility opens up of an immaterial existence after our bodies are gone. Now, I want to leave the arguments for physicalism for next time. And I want to ask, well, I'm actually interested to know, because I've tried to present this plausibly, I want to ask who thinks there is something right about this argument for dualism. There is something plausible about it. Yeah, it seems to me, and really I'm not decided on the dualism-physicalism question, it seems to me that there's something profound about it. Says, can anybody pinpoint a concern they have about this argument? Yes, at the back. Would you mind speaking a bit louder, please? Yes.
How does that affect? Is memory part of the brain function? So does that make my memory and my mind one?
Mm. I guess. Well, look, there is an interesting question in psychology about. One thing psychologists do is think about how different aspects of our mind connect to one another, right? Without having to worry about the relation to the brain. So one thing you could be asking is, how is my memory connected to the rest of my mental function? Okay, now that is a question which presumably empirical psychologists and other scientists have a lot to say about, but it's not our question today. Our question today is the mind a physical or a non-physical thing? But another way to take your point is to say, well, your memory, the experience of having a memory, could just as well be used in the exercise we just did now. I think Descartes would be comfortable in saying, bring up your memory of this beautiful day in Croatia. You have private and immediate access to this wonderful memory. Whereas, your access to your brain state when you are experiencing the memory is firstly mediated by instrumentation, and secondly, not at all private. Any of us, given the right instruments, can have a look. So that state of remembering for a Cartesian dualist, similarly, like the state of imagining, would count as an immaterial state rather than a physical one. Yes?
The problem about this point of view is to show how a non-physical thing, the mind, is tied to a physical thing. Because if it's not tied, why doesn't it wander around?
Yeah.
Why doesn't it inhabit other people?
Yes.
So you've got to show that it's tied to one particular person.
Yes. Why doesn't it inhabit other people? Yes.
Maybe it does.
That reminds me, when I was an undergraduate, I mean, philosopher, there's a long philosophical history of making extremely cruel, sarcastic remarks. And in a way, reading the history of philosophy amounts to reading a series of sarcastic remarks made by philosophers about their predecessors. But, I mean, to train to be a philosopher is really partly a training in irony and sarcasm. And I remember once I was an undergraduate doing a philosophy of mind course, and you can imagine. It attracted a number of people who spent much more time on the beach than you know, studying or coming to lectures. So somebody kind of wandered into the lecture and said, so like, what if, I think actually like you and me said to the lecture, and all of us are all part of like one big single mind. And the lecturer said, I hope not. So, why doesn't, if minds are immaterial, presumably the Cartesian dualist has a problem about explaining how they are tethered to bodies, in particular, presumably to brains. And that's something I want to talk a little bit about tomorrow. It is indeed a problem. You have to express this problem carefully. When you say, why don't they just wander around, presumably you're speaking not in a literal way, because if minds aren't material, they don't do any physical wandering about in space. But you could still express the worry in a way that doesn't imply that they do. You could say, how is it that immaterial mind can possibly be connected to a material brain? Let's see what time we have. We have time for one more question, so I'm hoping it'll be a question that's utterly incisive and profound. And I'm hoping it will be by somebody who hasn't spoken yet today. Yes.
Is it not possible that the mind is totally physical, in spite of your arguments, because by analogy, there may well be techniques we don't have today, but we may get tomorrow or the day after, which will allow us to intrude upon the mind by physical means. By analogy, it's known that parents have children more or less who look like them. Until relatively recently, one had no idea what the mechanism of that was. It's known, for example, last example, that when you see something, a part of the mind, of the brain back there, does something.
Yes.
But until 50 years ago, one had absolutely no way of correlating that piece of the brain which worked with the sensation of seeing. Is it not possible, as I said, in the future we will find a physical aspect of mind?
Okay, good. I am... a way to respond to this Cartesian argument, which relies on Leibniz's law, is to attempt to show that the apparent differences in properties between the mind and, let's say, the brain are not real differences at all. So let's take the argument I offered. What you would have to show is either that my access to my mental states isn't really private and isn't really immediate. That seems quite hard to do. It does seem to be a special memory of my own when I'm thinking of that marvelous day in Croatia, for example. It's private to me, and I don't need any instrumentation. I have it immediately. Or you could try to show that my access to my brain states isn't essentially any different. Perhaps you might say, technological advances might make access to my brain states indeed immediate and private in the way that access to my mental states are. It's difficult for me to imagine this, sure, because it feels like access to brain states is not private. It feels like we can all have a look at my brain. But maybe through some remarkable, currently perhaps unimaginable technology, we could do this. Now, the plan for tomorrow is, if you feel like a dualist, to shake your feeling by offering arguments for physicalism, then to think a little bit about which one we should choose, physicalism or dualism, and then to launch boldly into the question of whether we have free will. Our fourth and fifth topics aren't about what exists. They aren't metaphysical. They aren't about the fundamental nature of the world. We have free will. What kind of thing is the mind? Does God exist? They're ethical topics. They're going to be about what it is to be good and what the scope, the proper scope of free speech are. But for the moment, we're dealing in metaphysics, and I will see you tomorrow. Thank you very much.